pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Good morning. Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday, day after primary day. What a night it was. And we were up late last night compiling results from around the state. A few surprises. We'll get into those in just a moment. I'll walk you through what I saw and, kind of an outlook here. Coming up on the program, Bradley Jay, my colleague at Breitbart News, will be with me. He is the political deputy bureau chief there in Washington, D.C. for Breitbart News. We'll talk national politics, primarily Massey, Georgia, Trump's winning streak. We'll hear from him there. Also on the program today, Joey Clark from News Talk 93.1 in Montgomery, our Wednesday regular. And we'll wrap it up in the 11 o'clock hour with Scott Butcher from the Trussell Tribune. We'll talk about these statewide races as we will talk about this morning dominating the discussion, I am sure. I guess first off, we know Tommy Tuberville will be the gubernatorial nominee for the Republican Party. We know that Doug Jones will be the Democrat nominee for governor. And we should know, but we pretend like we don't know in the media, that Tommy Tuberville will trounce Doug Jones on November 3rd. But we are going to play this little charade and pretend this is a very serious election where you, the Alabama voter, could go either way. You just don't know any given day. Hey, he won in 2017. You just don't know, Jeff Poor. You think you know it all. But you go ahead and bet on it if you believe that. I guess we'll go through these races one by one by one. United States Senate, Jared Hudson closed late. Passed Steve Marshall late into count. And I can tell you what goes on here is Barry Moore pretty much support in all 67 counties. And he won. He was very strong in the Wiregrass, and he was strong down in our neck of the woods, but oddly very strong in the Shoals, Lauderdale, Colbert, and Franklin counties. Gets a plurality elsewhere: Huntsville, Montgomery, Mobile. Only loss really comes in Birmingham. Marshall does well, too, just not well enough. Only wins one county, I think. He picks up, he picked up several counties. That's not really fair. He dominated in his home county of Marshall County. Got a plurality in Walker County, and that's Jasper. Clay County in East Alabama, Talladega County, Chilton County, and Hale County for whatever reason. Jared Hudson, we'll go through the county. Clark County, as far south as he got there, did well there. Did well in Marengo County, did well in Greene, Pickens. These are black belt counties. One Tuscaloosa County, not a small feat. Fayette County, a very small county, dominated in Jefferson County, won by like 7,000 votes. Also did really well in Blount County. I believe he's a sheriff's deputy there. Won in Etowah County, that's Gadsden, St. Clair County, and Shelby County. But the trick there was he closed late because the boxes coming in from Jefferson County were slower to come in. There's just more to count, and it just takes a little time. It just takes a little time, and sure enough, that's it. That sets up a runoff. We think right now heads have been called officially. Barry Moore and Jared Hudson a couple of things on that. Low turnout, so you got to take Jared Hudson seriously if you're Barry Moore. Even though you won by 14 points, as things stand right now with 95% reporting. And that's a good 55,000 vote total lead. Very solid effort. But in a low turnout, it becomes less about percentages and more about raw votes. And if you could somehow run up the score and where your support is, and that's Jefferson County, I'm talking about Shelby County, Jefferson County, over the mountain suburbs, where there's a lot of Republican votes, and turnout lags into rural counties where Barry Moore support lies, particularly in the Wiregrass, that could cause problems. It's winnable. It's very winnable for Jared Hudson. But I will say this. I think Club for Growth is going to come in. They've already endorsed. They've already come in and hammered Steve Marshall a little. And I anticipate Trump-aligned forces are going to come in for Barry Moore. And that'll be a shot in the arm. June 16th, and we'll see where that goes. Let's keep going here. I'm skipping the Democrat races. Lieutenant Governor John Walt was out in a runoff. 2.5 percentage points. John Walt gets a plurality. Sort of similar to the Barry Moore phenomenon. But Wes Allen, he performed a mildly better than I thought. I thought he would have a ceiling of about 35%. Well, he got 38%. But I expected him to finish ahead of John Wall for a couple of reasons. Just, it didn't seem like the Wall campaign had really, really capitalized on the Trump endorsement. And I still don't believe that it has. And so I expect Wall's numbers, he outperformed my expectations significantly. I thought he'd get about 25, 30%. Wes Allen would get about 35%, 30, 35%, but still beat John Wall. And then the rest of the field with Rick Pate, Nicole Wadsworth, Pat Bishop, Stuart Tankersley would have enough votes left behind. And that turned out not to be the case. It was a two-man race from the get-go. Going to be interesting to watch that, but the story there is just, I think John Wall outperformed expectations. Because it's a tale of two campaigns. Wes Allen announces, in like 2025, early, he's running for lieutenant governor. Wall doesn't get in until the last day of qualifying. And he's playing catch up the entire time. AG's race. We got a runoff between Mitchell and Robertson. I thought Casey would perform slightly better. Mitchell gets in with some breathing room, 9 points. Casey wins a couple of counties here. She won her home county of Blount, and then she did really well in Covington County, of all places. But Catherine Robertson, maybe not quite the lead we thought she had going into this over Jay Mitchell, but still at 6-7 points. That's headed to her off. That will continue to be one to watch. Congressional race. Now, I don't know. WKRG had some numbers last night, and it looked like they just kind of came out of thin air. This is based on the Secretary of State's website. And I went and some of the counties post their returns in AL1. Some don't. Well, just two that I could find. And this was at 2 in the morning. But Mobile and Baldwin County post their returns. And they matched the Secretary of State's website. So we went with those. And Jerry Carl with a 9-point win over Rhett Marcus. in the ghost primary. I thought McKee would perform a little bit better. I think Rhett Marcus performed extraordinarily well, probably about where the best he could have hoped for. But it's just like that 2024 Barry Moore, Jerry Carl matchup. One half of the district just all in for Barry Moore, the other half all in for Jerry Carl. Baldwin County is sort of the battleground. You've got to, if you're the Wiregrass candidate, you've got to get enough votes in Baldwin County. But you can look at the map, and if you have one side's red, one side's green, and the green side is Rhett Marcus, and the other side is Jerry Carl, it went about as expected. I tell you what, 18 votes separated the two right there in the middle in Covington County. That's sort of the geographic center of the district, but just low turnout across the board in the Wiregrass. If they had better turnout in the Wiregrass, and they always have low turnout in the Wiregrass, Rhett probably closes the gap somewhat there and gets out of there, maybe keeps it within 5 points. So he probably performed slightly better than I had expected. But I don't think the Katie Britt endorsement or any of that really mattered. I think this district, and it's going away, I believe, is just based on your geographic loyalty. We have a very tribal state. And when it comes to politics, you know, your hometown guy, that's where your loyalties lie. I don't know if I'm, you know, Jerry Carl, you've got to be looking at places where maybe you're not as well known. I mean, it's just a handful of votes. But that's the key there. We'll go through some state legislative races throughout the program. A lot to talk about there. The two constitutional amendments pass. One was a little closer than the other. Let's see. Auditor Andrew Sorrell wasn't even close between he and Derek Chen. I expected that to be closer. I think a lot of us did. But 2-1, or more than 2-1, Sorrell, the incumbent. Public Service Commission, Matt Gentry, 75% of the vote. Ziegler and Beaker in a runoff in place two. Those are the two we were watching. Obviously, Caroline Dobson running against Chris Horn. She wins that. Young Boozer wins his for treasurer. And then Board of Education, State Board of Education race up in North Alabama. We'll go to runoff. Rest went, I guess, as expected. Let's see here. So we'll go through real quick. Let's see how much time we got. But we're going to have to get to a break here. 251-343-0106. I'll try to get through some of these, at least maybe the Senate races, state Senate races in the next segment. Stick around. This is the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. What you doing?
Late again, watching TV with my best friend, laughing at the late night show. I don't know what's wrong with me, cause I know I need my rest, but if I don't stay up all night, sleep all day, I ain't at my best.
Hey, welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday, day after primary election day. 251-343-0106. I guess here's a question about AL1. 40%, pretty stout number. Is that enough to keep out anybody unexpected from running against Jerry Carl and our Rhett Marcus? in AL1 and AL2, respectively. Is it going to be the same field of candidates? So I think Carl Sidwell, who did well, Jimmy Dees in AL1, AL2, Brett Marcus, Joshua McKee, John Mills and James Richardson running there. Would we see a Dick Brubaker at AL2? Would we see a Chris Elliott? Would Elliott give up a Senate? I mean, he won his Senate race pretty convincingly last night against Mike Vann. Almost 3-1. Now, they spent big, and he opened up the floodgates there, but he got a good number. Real quick, state Senate races. The big one, I guess, we're all going to talk about is Greg Allbritton going down to Terry Waters. That really changes the gambling discussion. It doesn't put gambling off to take it off the table by any stretch. But he was sort of the puzzle piece missing there when we talked about PCI's interest. He single-handedly killed the gambling bill in 2024. The PCI didn't like it, so he walked away from it and didn't vote for it. And it died by one vote. I think the difference here is with Governor Tuberville that there will be more of a leadership sort of voice from the governor's office, twisting arms and not just not just some mid-level staffer going down to Lance Bell's office and bullying him around trying to get his vote. It will be more of a strategic effort there. And I think the House, even though they lost a few votes, and Alpha had a great night last night, but we'll get into that later in the program. The House won't be the problem. It's always going to be the Senate when it comes to gambling. But we'll go through some of these one by one here. Gudger, the pro tem, he wins his race 2-1. People thought maybe he was in trouble. That turned out not to be true at all. Andrew Jones, who a lot of people thought was going to go down. He was the most vulnerable going into this cycle. He got on the bad side of a couple of issues. He is a Cherokee County guy running in a district population dominated by Etowah County and Gadsden, but pulled out an impressive 8-point win last night in the 10th district. Turned out he was not really in trouble. Randy Price beats Gerald Dial. Not sure why Gerald Dial was running. He's almost 90 years old. But Randy Price retains his seat. Dan Roberts goes down. This is a tough one. Dan Roberts, kind of your is about as well as you, as conservative as you could get for that Mountain Brook State Senate district. Loses to Ortiz last night by 4 points. Jabbo Wagner, a lot closer than a lot of people had expected, gets an 8-point win. Jabbo Wagner has been in the Alabama legislature off and on since 1966. Will at least serve one more term as he approaches 90 years old. Terry Waters beating Greg Allbritton. That tightened as the night went on, but Waters gets a 4-point win. It is a big, big deal when the general fund chairman gets beat. Allbritton wielded a lot of power. He carried a lot of bills over his time. Losing last night, kind of a stunner. Let's see. Jay Hovey holds on. I thought Doug Cannon would perform a little bit better. He had some money behind him, but Hovey beats him 2-1. That's a Lee County, Tallapoosa, Russell County State Senate District. That's Auburn. That's where he only won it by one vote against Tom Watley 4 years ago. As I mentioned, Elliott dominating his race. And it probably the one that was of most interest to this listening audience. Rusty Glover gets a 10-point win over Doug Harwell. It always felt like a Rusty Glover district and a race he was going to win. Harwell gave it a good shot, a good run at it, but there's just too many loyalties there that go back decades. I think that makes that a hard one to win. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Good night, angel. Sleep tight, darling. And close your pretty brown eyes.
Look away.
to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Wednesday morning, day after primary day. Well, like I said, throughout the program, we'll get into some of these races, and then we'll do a recap at some point, I'm sure. But we'll do recaps and prognostications. I want to hear from you, 251-343-0106. We'll get to your text probably in the next couple of segments, so keep those coming as well. Joining us now on the line, he is my colleague at Breitbart News. Bradley Jay is with us. Bradley, how are you?
Mr. Poor, doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for making time. I guess we'll start Kentucky and Thomas Massey. I think I expected it to be a little closer, but probably not a surprise that he gets beat. My quick analysis of it was this. Under normal circumstances, it's a coin flip, but I think being that Northern Kentucky district and being in the Cincinnati market, it's very expensive. He was just going to get outspent, and there was just more resources for his opponent.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm with you. I thought it would be a coin flip. A lot of the conventional wisdom amongst political pundits over the past like 48 hours or so was that Gowron had it in the bag, but 10 points is a butt whooping. You know how the libertarians are. They'll plow through a crowd of children just to run up to a stranger to tell them that they're a libertarian. So it's a little bit but yet it's a little bit difficult to poll them because they're so distrustful of polls and all that. Maybe rightfully so. So I thought that his vote would have been a little undercounted in the polling. But it was Gowron's vote that was undercounted. So yeah, big win for Trump. Massey's going to be a big headache going forward, but he was already a headache, so not much will change. I don't know if you watched much of his concession speech last night. It was very strange. He toasted a glass of unpasteurized milk to the memory of his late wife with his new wife right there. He made it very clear that he was hinting at a possible run for president, that we hadn't seen the last of him. He had a lot of seemingly prepared material, almost like he was at the comedy store. It was very, very strange from a very odd man. He reminds me a lot of Mo Brooks, who I know goes on the show in a lot of ways, in that it's I don't know what it is psychologically about Massey, but like he needs to be hated. It makes him think if he's in the minority that he's the smartest guy in the room and that he's above everyone else. It's just really, really bizarre behavior from him, especially, frankly, since his wife died. It was like something changed. Well, he was unleashed.
I think it's this. And like, I think these guys in their heart, they're trying to do the right thing, and in some ways they are doing the right thing. But like the deal with the Mo Brooks and the deal with the Thomas Massey is they'd rather win the debate trophy than work within the system. Now the system is terrible, the system sucks, but the system is always going to prevail, and you got to win your election if you really want change. If you really want to move the dial in your favor, you don't just do it. You got to do it and work at it incrementally. And these guys who I think they have a very warped perception of just the world is what it is. It's a fallen world. You can't just come in and be a bull in the china shop. You got to work within the boundaries. And some people are good at it. But then the pure ideologues, they always collapse under their own weight.
Well, Saul Alinsky may have been a scumbag, but he wasn't a fool. You're exactly right. You have to work within the system. If you want to change the system, you have to work it through the system. 99 times out of 100, that's how it works. The thing about Massey, like, I feel like maybe he did get what he wanted. He always claimed to be some type of purist. He said that Washington is broken. I'm the only one who is trying to do things the right way. But as you pointed out, like, he didn't try to fix it. Like, you're not a member of the media as a member of Congress. You actually have levers of power within your reach. yet he never stuck out his hand for them. He never offered any serious legislative proposals that weren't just messaging bills to put his name out there. The White House rightfully stopped working with him on all these things that he was against him on, whether it was spending bills to keep Trump's government open, whether it was the big, beautiful bill that was included the majority of Trump's 2024 campaign promises. He didn't want to work with him. He didn't want anything. He didn't want to get the yes. He didn't want anything in return for his vote. He just wanted attention, and they finally figured that out and stopped working with him.
Well, and this is the thing, like, if you are a – and there's a lot of people who are kind of upset about this Massey defeat. You got to elect more Masseys if you really believe this. You can't just expect it for one guy out of 435 to be that guy. I mean, I get it. Like, he's a good poster child for the movement, but he, like I said, he's not working within the parameters, and the parameters are going to be what they are. And you got to win elections. We have a system of government that, you know, people vote. He lost one of the most important elements to it. He lost the court of public opinion. He got outspent. It's not a perfect system, but I'm just hearing this and I'm getting blown up about it. A lot of people just disappointed. They couldn't, you know, the Thomas Massey lost, but you have an understanding of our own system, and you kind of have to accept a defeat or you're going to always be let down.
Was it Churchill who said, democracy is the worst system of government except for all the others? We're not a pure government. And in fact, our governmental system is much more complex than a pure democracy. Something just didn't make sense with Massey. He made it more about himself. And I think because of that, many people who would have been sympathetic with a lot of what he was saying ended up getting turned off. And if you saw his concession speech, I mean, it was just a big Massey party. Again, a lot of times you can see congressmen or politicians fake it after they lose and they're making a concession speech. Massey seemed overjoyed. Like, he was so proud that it was the most expensive House race in history. And by the way, Massey made it clear he had all the money that he needed. People can talk about AIPAC money and Trump's money coming in and swinging that race. Massey spent millions and millions of dollars and made the point that in the months leading up to the election day, there wasn't a single week where he didn't have the money that he needed to do what he wanted. It was about, I think it came down to just him personally. Folks didn't like him, and they didn't like the way that he did things, and it allowed Ed Gowron to basically campaign from his basement, yet still beat Massey by double digits.
Well, it's the difference between him and like a Ron Paul, because Ron Paul, he would vote no, and he would give his speeches, but you get in those committees, and Ron Paul's a wheeler and dealer. You know, he worked within that. And he made his symbolic gestures on the floor, but they really didn't matter. They always had the votes, right? So with Massey, they don't have that luxury. The things are so marginal. The margins are so tight. You didn't have the luxury of a Ron Paul to be able to vote no on everything. They needed his vote, and he didn't play ball with them.
Yeah, and look, they gave Massey a seat on the incredibly powerful Rules Committee, which, as you know, dictates what comes to the House floor, what the parameters of debate and amendment votes are. He squandered that because he wouldn't work. He was just a guaranteed no. He was a grandstander, and I hate calling people a grandstander. I really do, because that term is so misused. But I think it applies in this situation. They gave him a seat, I believe, on the Weaponization Subcommittee, which was an incredibly powerful subcommittee, and which would have allowed him to actually pursue a lot of these issues that he claims to care about. Yet did he use it? No. he partnered with Ro Khanna and other radical Democrats to get in the news and do all this stuff. Again, just like, you're a member of Congress, brother. You've got the ability to actually move the needle on things, but instead of moving the needle on the issues that he actually cared about, he tried to move his own needle, and I think that that's what got him in the end.
Talk about Georgia. I'm not terribly surprised, but if you're Trump, you got to feel good about the way your candidates performed there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, look, Rick Jackson declared it's the same way with a lot of these self-funders. They want their money to do their campaigning for them, so they always get into these races at the very last minute. I mean, Rick Jackson's a billionaire. He got into the race the last minute. He said that he spent $73 million of his own money into that campaign, running against Burke Jones, lieutenant governor, who Trump has endorsed and been, I mean, they've had a long-time close relationship. Burt Jones, I think the most polling did not have him emerging as the leader in that race. Yet, I think by a handful of points, 2 or 3 points, he was ahead of Rick Jackson going into that runoff. That's kind of changed the conventional wisdom in that race, whereas Jackson was going to be able to outspend whatever bump that Jones would get from the Trump endorsement. I don't know if that's the case. That's going to be one to watch. Certainly in the Senate GOP primary over there with Mike Collins, who's hewn very closely to Trump's side since arriving in Congress just a few years ago, carried the Laken Riley Act in the House, which, of course, was passed into law. He had over 40% in a crowded primary without Trump's endorsement. He's going to be running against Governor Brian Kemp, puppet Derek Dooley, who most of us in SEC country know who he is from his coaching days. Dooley got, what, a little less than 30%, I believe, maybe in the, closer to the mid-20s. You got to think Mike Collins is riding high going into that runoff. Now we're waiting to see if Trump will get involved.
One more here. Greg Abbott getting Trump's endorsement. This was pretty much expected, wasn't it?
Or Ken Paxton.
That's what I meant.
I don't know that it was expected. First off, Ken was leading in polls before Trump made his endorsement. I think that the writing was on the wall. But for Trump to actually pull the trigger and make the endorsement for Ken when every single person in Washington, whenever they got a moment with Trump, they used it to pitch him endorsing Cornyn. And the Senate Republican Conference, this might be the single biggest thing that Trump has done to change the trajectory of the Senate Republican Conference. The mood yesterday at that Senate Republican weekly lunch, and not just from the type of people who we think of when we think of establishment senators, almost all of them were ticked off. Look, every senator looks in the mirror and sees a president, but until then, they see the Senate as their own fiefdom. Whether it's Trump or any other president, they think that, well, he'll either be in office 4 or 8 years, so we're going to outlast him. We've just got to put up with him. They are sick and tired of Donald Trump running things by the end of this term. It'll have been 12 years, absent just a couple years where we weren't really sure whether or not Trump was going to retain his lead of the party. Now he's stronger than ever. These senators are so furious. And Nick Gilbertson, our Breitbart White House correspondent, we were brainstorming yesterday before he sat in the new media chair about what to ask Vice President Vance at the press conference. And he ended up asking him if the endorsement of Paxton sent a message, not just to Republican senators in cycle who are considering whether or not they're going to run again in 2 years, but if it sent a message to any MAGA-aligned potential challengers to those senators. And the VP's answer was making the rounds yesterday with Republican senators. He said, yes, it's in a strong message. Number one, that you can't be bought by the special interest if you're going to be a Republican senator. And it's in a message that you actually have to represent those who sent you to Washington. Wow, that really ticked off Republican senators who thought that Cornyn had been a model senator, that they argued that he was the whip during Trump's first term and had helped move all these great Trump initiatives, which tells you how out of touch they are.
Yeah,
we all remember the notorious bromance between Senate Republicans and the first Trump administration. Give me a break.
Yeah, because it was just McConnell, and they were hoping Russia collusion. They were pumping the brakes on everything Trump wanted. He was a Russian plant, and they weren't helping there. And then it was that first 100 days, and I remember watching Cornyn go up on Fox News, being pressed by Tucker Carlson, hey, well, why aren't y'all moving? And he got a bunch of hubbada. I mean, Cornyn was never he was never a guy that was going to be a reliable ally for not just Trump, but this whole like kind of Trump brand of populism.
Yeah, he ended up what he and the Republican Senate ended up pushing in Trump's first term was a bunch of watered down legislation and a bunch of really weak nominees who were palatable to Senate Republicans but weren't MAGA. We've seen the fruits of that in many of these cases that have risen through the courts over the past several years. The liberal media always points out, this was a Trump-appointed judge.
Trump's first cabinet was awful.
Yep.
And he had to wheel and deal with the Senate to get, just some of the dead weight, and it wasn't long for this world, but I mean, he had to have Elaine Chao as his transportation secretary. I mean, what kind of garbage is that? Anyway, hey, Bradley, folks want to find you online. What do we need to do?
Breitbart.com and on X or Twitter or Instagram at Bradley AJ.
Bradley, we appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
Great being with you, Jeff.
All right, let's get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. To the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Still to come on the program, Joey Clark from News Talk 93.1 in Montgomery and Scott Butcher from the Trustville Tribune. Tim, I voted for it. Marcus can take the church pew salesman. Mr. Doug, you were right on Massey, my bad. Unnamed texter. Hey, Jeff, this is Billy D. Let's all agree the only reason Doug Jones won in 2017 was because he was going against a judge who was absolutely nuts and accused of pedophilia. But people outside of Alabama aren't really thinking about that. And that's what he's going to try to run on. Scrovereen. Why did Democrats back a black gubernatorial candidate? Why is the Dem machine silencing and suppressing the black vote? Mommy issues. Certainly, Jeff, we don't expect the uneducated boards of the state to vote with the candidate as its first interest. Republicans have had power for decades with nothing to show for it. Still broke, taking blue state taxes nearly in last in education with the mortality rates that outpaced the rural countries. Yeah, winners. I'd say this in response. Democrats had power for more than a century. They sure didn't make any headway. They lost, in fact. Democrats were running the state long before Republicans were. And that's what you need to know, mommy issues, that Democrats couldn't quite get it together. And that's why Republicans got elected. Continuing on here, B. Dark. I just wish Steve Marshall would have stayed in the governor's race, then Alabama would have a reason to vote for a governor. I don't think that was ever in the cards, B-Dark. Troy Fan, Jeff, I don't understand the need for the Alabama constitutional amendment regarding DA compensation. The Constitution of Alabama is a complicated document, and I couldn't begin to tell you why that was needed. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Now, if your leather jacket means to you what this hat means to me,